on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Rivalry weekend is here. We look around the league and decide which of these are actually rivalries. Which matchups are we most looking forward to watching this weekend? We get some injury updates, some good, some bad. Tarek Skubal might be back sooner. Cal Raleigh on the IL for the first time in his career. That ain't great. And then, of course, it's Friday, so we give you another jam-packed edition of the good, the bad, and the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that for one weekend a year leans into hatred. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and it's rivalry weekend in MLB.
That is that's our brand, folks. You know we are all about animosity. And on this that is what I think about when I think about hate, is that reference you just made. But it is Rivalry Weekend, the second edition, I believe, after MLB introduced this a year ago. However, it is a bit of a convoluted
Finally some rivalries and
strange concept. And let's get into it. It's our opener.
Grrr, said the league. Here's the deal. We have two leagues. We have the American and we have the National. And there are rivalries between these two leagues, most of which are geographic, all of which the league wants to highlight at one particular point in time. And so they have created this thing called Rivalry Weekend, where the cross-league, mostly, matchups are unfurled for us over the course of 3 days. You are familiar with the big ones, Yankees, Mets, Cubs, White Sox, Dodgers, Angels. You are probably less familiar with the smaller ones like D-backs, Rockies, or Rangers, Astros, which are less familiar because they are the most familiar because these teams are just like playing all the time because they're division rivals. This is silly. This is bizarre. This is fun. And in some places, this is meaningful. I think that baseball, more than any other sport, is so hyper-regional. And where those regional lines are drawn on maps between states within communities, I'm always compelled by. If anybody ever tweets out any map of fandom, it will go viral in an instant. And Rivalry Weekend, silly name and all, is a good time to highlight some of these showdowns.
Yeah, I think so. And we can kind of categorize these, and how compelling these matchups are certainly depends on the personnel involved. Yep. And in some cases, the time on the calendar, right? I think at this point, doing it this early in the season feels less high stakes. While I think in some cases,
I disagree.
Some of these teams. Okay. All right. Well, I guess we could just start there. Why is that?
It maybe it does feel a little less high stakes, but the reason I think this is the right time for it is that there's more towns with hope alive. Mm. So Cubs White Sox is the perfect entryway into this. The White Sox, we'll start here. The White Sox are 22-21. They have won 5 in a row. This is the first time that these two teams have faced one another over 500 since 2008. Okay. If these two teams were playing in 2 months, with all due respect to the Chicago White Sox, I'll take the under on them being 500. And so as the Cubbies roll down to the South Side this weekend, the energy at Guaranteed Rate Field is going to have real fizz and real zest. Now, are there stakes to these matchups? No, but guess what? These matchups really exist for vibes more than for determining standings. Like Yankees Mets is another example of this, where like these teams are not actually competing against one another in the standings. They're competing against one another for the hearts and minds of a metropolis. And so when they match up, I like that it happens earlier on in the season where, outcomes won't be won or lost. Like no team is missing or making the playoffs because of these games. And I think that is a really good backdrop for it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think this is also just the product of the balanced schedule. Now, these are interleague matchups that we were seeing pretty frequently, but it's a way to kind of lean into these all at once as opposed to scattering them throughout the season. And I do think that reserving this or having this marquee weekend in May is cool to kind of add some spice to a part of the schedule that isn't necessarily as compelling and save your juicy division matchups that will decide the division races for September. I think yep. that is, if you can decide how the schedule is balanced, which in some cases, I think since the league switched to the balanced schedule, they've done a good job of, but also in some cases have done a bad job of, I think reserving those division matchups and backloading them to September is not a bad thing, even if it's weird when some of these division teams aren't playing each other until June. I will also point out that some of these matchups are going to happen again later in the season. So on the if the Mets do revive their season and are fighting for a wild card spot, well, guess what? The Yankees are coming to town, or sorry, they're going to have to go to the Bronx in the middle of September. So maybe that series by then
yeah.
will have some more spice. But for now, we're going to focus on the ones that are happening this weekend. And the ones you just mentioned, I think, are not just already considered the most convincing rivalry compared to some of these other ones that we're going to see this weekend, but also I think too, because of where these teams are at, the Yankees, Mets, Cubs, and White Sox are definitely the ones I think we're most excited to watch this sure. weekend.
So let's do Yankees, Mets. If I rewind the clock a week, this Yankees Mets series was shaping up to be a nail in the coffin potential showdown, where the Yankees were rolling and the Mets were a disaster. And if the Yankees had rolled into Citi Field and swept it, we could have had Mets are dead, like Mets are dead, Mets are dead, right? But over the last week, the tides have turned somewhat, where the Yankees have lost 5 of 6, getting swept in Milwaukee, losing 2 out of 3 in Baltimore, while the Metsies just completed a sweep of their own at home against the Tigers. They seem invigorated by the arrival of top prospect AJ Ewing, who we talked about on the last show. He has been incredibly fun to watch. Carson Benj, another rookie who started with the team on opening day, was very bad to start the season, but things have really clicked for him over the last 3 weeks or so, and he's been the Mets' best hitter over that stretch. The Mets are finding something. It is happening slowly, and there is much time yet to go, but this is a massive step in the right direction. And if they go out and they win this series at home against the Yankees, I think that would be that would keep the good vibes rolling. But the Yankees, meanwhile, we're not quite at, is this team okay? Is this team in trouble discourse? Anytime you lose 5 of 6, you start to shrug your shoulders a little bit. And if they go in to Citi Field and they lose the series, like, we'll have articles, we'll have conversations, we'll have some agita bubbling up in the Bronx.
Yeah, and the Mets are now within striking distance of not being in last place anymore, which we haven't been able to say for quite some time, especially since the Phillies
raised the banner
started to heat up. Now they're going to need a favorable result between the Marlins and Rays. And that's actually an interesting one because that will impact both of these clubs, right? Because the Marlins sure. are the team that is closest to the Mets in the standings, and the Rays.
That's what everyone at Citi Field yeah. is going to be thinking about. When all the New Yorkers at Citi Field, they file in, and they put the Rays Marlins score up on the big board. You're right. Like, they'll be locked into that, into the Citrus Bowl for sure.
If we are hyper fixating on the standings in the middle of May, then yeah, they should be playing the Rays Marlins game at Citi Field, because that is going to be part of this conversation. If the Yankees get swept by the Mets and the Rays sweep the Marlins, then suddenly the Yankees are, you know, 5 games back or yep. whatever, and it's like, oh my God, here we go. So. But I do think that seeing the Mets finally, I mean, it was their first sweep of the year. So that speaks to just yeah. the fact that they have not gathered any amount of momentum really at any point since the beginning of the season. Right. And so them taking advantage of another struggling Tigers team, we just joked recently about how the whole Fromber mess allowed the Red Sox to kind of gather some momentum, which has since not really actually happened. And as we mentioned, maybe that will end up being the case with the Mets as well. And the Yankees come to town and kick their ass, and sweeping the Tigers apparently doesn't actually do anything for you. But sometimes these series can help get you back on track. And I think just seeing how these kids are playing for the Mets is certainly making them more watchable. I'm more likely to want to tune in for them.
Oh my God.
But they still have a lot of other problems on the roster that they'll have to prove against the Yankees team that we do believe is still very good.
So I wrote a little bit about the upcoming Subway Series, and I looked at it through the lens of who are the main characters going to be. Now, obviously, Aaron Judge, anytime he steps on the field, is the main character, but I kind of focused on Ben Rice, who has been the second best hitter on the Yankees this year, maybe even the best, but he is 3 for his last 24 after he got off the... He wasn't on the IL technically, but he came back from like a bruised hand, so he's been... meh since then. I'm curious if he's fully healthy. I wrote a little bit about Juan Soto, who, hey, do you remember, Jordan? He was on the Yankees. Remember that? And he got booed into oblivion last year when he went to Yankee Stadium. This series is in Citi Field, but anytime, you know, he is a main character whenever there is a Subway Series. And then Anthony Volpe, who 0-for-3 in his first game back with a strikeout. His struggles are Mets fans' punchlines. He is going to hear it this weekend. Oh my God. It will be very, I think that, is he going to be like the main event in the Subway Series? No, but you better believe that he will receive a chirp or two.
See, I mean, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I think Volpe playing at home is way more interesting than this weekend. And, you know, he made his...
You think this is like a soft onboarding?
Well, I'm just saying that, like, I think Anthony Volpe, if he is... I'm much more interested in Yankees fans' perception of Anthony Volpe than Mets fans. I think that's the point that I'm making. Now, of course, there will be Yankees fans in attendance as well. So maybe he will be hearing from his own fans as well if he's, you know, making errors and going 0-for-3. But... from that standpoint, I think Volpe is an interesting character, regardless of where these games are being played. But yeah, I think it would be, I'm more intrigued by his time back in the Bronx, which could be, as we mentioned, very abbreviated because Jose Caballero will be back soon.
And then the other one is Cam Schlittler, who came up last season after the Subway Series were played and so has never faced the Mets. He is... I talked to him last week, too, when the O's were hosting the Yankees. That dude is so confident in a way that is, like, really striking. He talks about his own pitching in a very, like, borderline pompous way that clearly enables pure dominance on the mound. He is a – here you go, Jordan. He's a Schlitzer. And I think that he could totally go into Citi Field – and rile the crowd up a bit and become a main character in this rivalry. Nolan McLean for the Mets also has not played in the Subway Series. He threw yesterday and so won't pitch this time around. So I didn't really include him as a main character. And then, of course, Benjamin Ewing, the two guys who have invigorated the Mets as all of their old heads are on the IL. So this is going to be a fun series. I'm really excited to follow along. We'll have Cam Schlittler against Clay Holmes on Friday, David Peterson, Carlos Rodon on Saturday, and then Freddie Peralta against Ryan Weathers coming off, what was it, 6 no-hit innings against the Orioles? That will be on Sunday. All right, let's hop on our bike and ride out to Chicago, as I did one time, and talk about the Windy City rivalry, Cubs-White Sox, which has real sauce this year for the first time in quite a while.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that fun fact before, first time them facing each other, both over 500 since 2008, excluding 2020, for those wondering. But I know that there was nobody there in 2020 to watch those games, and so this will be a very different experience. I am just so glad that this game is on the South Side. I think that this is... has to be the most in. I know that the White Sox have played postseason games not that long ago, but this has to be one of the most anticipated home games and home series in a really long time. I know it's early May, but with the way that the White Sox are playing, them having just swept the Royals, they've won 5 in a row, you can look at them and be like, okay, relax, 22 and 21, what's the big deal? I mean, these fans have been through some serious stuff recently. And to see them start to come out of this rebuild, to see, I think what you're just seeing is kind of a classic thing sometimes you see with young players on rebuilding clubs as they come out of it, which, especially for like the Chase Mydrots and some of the really newer guys, Sam Antonacci, that team that lost 500 games a few years ago, that ain't their problem.
Stink ain't there.
You know, that's
stink ain't
that's
there.
That's not their burden. Now, some of these guys did go through that, and I'm sure that informs their appreciation for what's happening. But for the most part, these other guys, like, why can't we be a good baseball team? We're the White Sox. Like, I'm good. I believe in myself. I'm succeeding in the majors as this young guy. And so I think it's just this really cool blend. You can really tell that is a team that is playing with confidence. And while I agree that I think over the long haul, the talent deficit is probably going to catch up with the White Sox, right now, it's not like anyone else in the AL Central is surging ahead. So I think they can continue to enjoy this a little bit longer. And you know, to have the opportunity to continue to make a statement against the Cubs, who have cooled off a little bit since their two ridiculous hot streaks, I think this is going to be really cool.
Let's head out to LA County, Orange County, where the Angels are going to be hosting the Dodgers. Did you know that these two stadiums, both of which are technically belong to teams that are listed in Los Angeles, are the same distance away as the Orioles and the Nats? Like, the drive from Angel Stadium to Dodger Stadium, I think it's like 44 miles. And Nats Park to Camden Yards is also like 43, 44 miles. So,
okay. Yeah. I mean, listen, we're going to get to Orioles Nationals here too. This is still a, even if it's not
drain
really
the swamp,
the same
the Beltway
city,
Bowl.
If it's not quite the same city or zip code or whatever you want to call it, this is still certainly a rivalry people care about, but also not really, because the Angels have been so bad for so long. They have the worst record in baseball. And now that Otani's on the other team, I mean, sure, you have Trout, and of course, Trout I'm thinking about. I just wrote about him. But at the very least, we certainly have some compelling pitching
matchups
in this one.
We're all thinking about Trout, man. I mean, the way that you said it, it was like, you know, he just experienced like a tragic loss. We're thinking about Mike.
Well,
he has to on the Angels. We're thinking of him. He's in our thoughts.
Correct. That's exactly, you are describing it perfectly. Now, of course, Otani is the other one that is the main character in every game he plays in, but certainly as he returns to Anaheim, how much does he get booed, if at all? But I'm looking at these pitching matchups. I'm looking at Justin Robleski, who finally had a blip in his last start, but also not, because he threw 8 2/3. Jose Soriano, who has just been incredible, and I think this is another opportunity for him to announce his presence as a legitimately awesome pitcher. And then Sunday could really be an interesting pitching matchup. I don't know if this is fully confirmed, but the way the Angels were talking about it, I think that this is possible. So it'll be Roky Sasaki for the Dodgers. And then it seems like Grayson Rodriguez is heading towards making his Angels debut. He struck out, I believe, 11 or 12 in a rehab outing recently. Sounds like they were just kind of taking it easy with him. He was never really that injured. He's just kind of, they had other starters that they wanted to go with, and they wanted to take it easy with him after his issues last season. Unfortunately, with Grayson, we never really know what's going on there because of just what it's been the last few seasons. But obviously someone we certainly root for, someone we've had on the show before, and someone we like to watch pitch. So if he is coming back this weekend, that would be a quite the challenge to have to deal in his first game back with the Angels, or first game with the Angels officially. But that could be an interesting one between Roky and Grayson.
Let's move out to the Bay, or Bay adjacent, where the Sacktown Yolo County A's are going to be hosting the Giants. This series itself, I know the A's are in first. They're hanging on to that that advantage in the AL West. I'm interested in how these rivalries are going to change when the A's move, right? So the Athletics are set to go to Vegas, presumably starting in 2028. Do you think the rivalry matchups will change as a result? Like, it doesn't make sense for those two teams to be playing anymore. Vegas is way closer to Phoenix, culturally, geographically, than it is to San Francisco. And it would probably make sense to reorient that. Now, maybe if we get a team in Salt Lake City down the road, Salt Lake City, Vegas is probably makes the most sense. But like what I would do, here's my proposal. You do Vegas A's against the Diamondbacks. You have the Giants play the Mariners because culturally Seattle and San Francisco makes a lot of sense. And then you do San Diego against Colorado because those two teams are the weird stepchilds of this thing anyway. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the more simpler one, if you're keeping the divisional matchups, we'll just do Giants-Rockies. Maybe we can – we're going to need the Rockies to get good and like start some fights with the Giants. Then you would have a much more natural swap if you want to go Phoenix and Vegas. But yeah, this is a strange one. I mean, last year – we talked about it speculating because last year's rivalry weekend was in San Francisco. And at the time it was, okay, are the A's fans that now aren't A's fans going to show up to Oracle Park and root for the A's who left them? Probably not.
Probably
not. In this case, you have a series in Sacramento where we still don't even totally understand what the state of A's fandom is. And it's the same park as the Giants AAA affiliate, and I'm sure there are plenty of Giants fans in Sacramento, too. So I expect it will be a heavy Giants fan representation, but just a strange situation.
And then the other thing is, you know, we've all kind of assumed that we're getting a team in Nashville at some point, which would obviously mean that team would be matched up with the Braves, which would leave the Red Sox out to dry. Maybe they could just play Northeastern that weekend again. Moving along with these matchups, I would say those are the four that are in the same, you know, city or have been in at points. And then we have Orioles, Nats. I will not be at that. Know your beat, Jake. What a shame. The DC guy running away for the Beltway Bowl. We have Reds, Guardians. What do they call this? The I-66? No, I-60. What is the I-80, I-75? I don't know what road it is that connects these two.
The Ohio Cup. This is not an interstate associated
The match. Ohio Cup?
Wow, Jake really has noticed nothing about this. This is like a complete lack of...
Is there a real cup?
He has never even acknowledged... Listen, do you hear the East Coast elitism in Jake's voice right now? It's honestly disgusting. This is a horrific... Now, I say that as I sit here in my Boston hotel room. I also will not be there this weekend, so shame on
me. There's
a
cup.
But
listen, a real cup?
This is a level of disregard for part of my culture that is gross, frankly. Mm. So the Ohio Cup will be taking
your
place
culture
at
your
at
Ohio Cleveland. Culture is my costume.
That's a fun one. Then we also have Marlins at Rays. We have Royals at Cardinals. We have Brewers at Twins and Phillies at Pirates. Some of those are more border related than, you know, intrastate situations. But from a geography standpoint, those are the ones. Blue Jays, Tigers, I guess, sort of fits into that as well in terms of proximity. And then the four other ones we have are Red Sox, Braves, which is strange. Padres, Mariners, which is its own strange rivalry. The Vetter Cup, which... I don't know if we need to spend time reflecting on how silly that one is. And then just because I guess you have to end up stuck with a couple of these other ones, Rangers, Astros, and D-backs, Rockies. Now, Rangers, Astros, at least you have the, you know, the Texas part of it all. But this is not what this is about. This is not this. That's a different weekend where you have a bunch of divisional matchups. So I don't know. Maybe do those fans feel bad? Do they wish they could face someone else? Who are their bigger rivals? I don't know. But that's the slate. So, yeah, are there any other of this, the rest of the slate, if there is one? I think Phillies Pirates is the one that jumps out to me.
Yeah, Wheeler against Skeens on Sunday is great. The one that I love culturally and I would love to go write about and experience is Brewers Twins, which must be the best. When the Twins go to the Brewers at AmFam, that has to be the best tailgating experience in baseball. With the Twins fans coming in. I'm just very interested in that culturally. And then Red Sox Braves is the perfect time to break out your Legume Connects, your Beantown Bean Unis, as the Braves used to be in Boston. They used to be the Bean Eaters. Were they the Bean Eaters or the Red Sox were the Bean Eaters? Were the Braves ever eating beans or they were always Braves?
The Braves were the Bean Eaters. No, that's how we ended up on this whole discussion because
they had the best start since the Bean Eaters.
So, but that's a good point. I guess I didn't really think about the fact that were the Red Sox also the Bean? No, that's weird. The Red Sox were they were the Americans before they were the Red Sox, but now they've never been eating beans. So, yeah, hopefully the Braves can show them what's up, but. Yeah, I mean Phillies Pirates, of course, the poop bowl that gets me every time. I hope that they have adjusted the score bug to make sure they give us poop to start each of these three.
Poop. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, the Phillies logo is a P, the Pirates logo is a P, and when the game starts 0-0, it looks like poop. P00P looks like poop. All right, let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll go around the league.
Before we take a break, let me remind everyone that the all-new 2026 Soccer Pick'em is here, just in time for the world's biggest soccer tournament. Make picks each round, earn points, climb the leaderboard. You can play solo, create a private group with your friends, or join a public group to play with other fans. Or you could join a Yahoo Sports group and see if you can beat us. Join at yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em. That's yahoofantasy.com/soccerpick'em.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's talk about injuries and go around the hospital. I mean, around the league. We'll start with the most expensive arm on the planet. No, I'm not talking about Georgian arm wrestler Levon Degashvili. I'm talking about Tarek Skubal.
Unbelievable. Transition, introduction to this topic.
I pronounced his last name wrong. I'd like a do-over. Levon Saginashvili, nicknamed the Georgian Hulk, considered the greatest arm wrestler of all time. Okay? Know your beat, Jake. Know your history.
The question is, will he ever need to undergo arthroscopic surgery to ensure that he can perform at his best? Because that is the case. For Tigers left-hander Tarek Skubal, and since we got the initial news that he was going to need this procedure to address the loose bodies in his elbow, which we have since learned really just one little guy getting after it. We have now some real updates. We spoke about how some of the initial reporting from John Heyman was a little vague and maybe optimistic to a degree that felt empty and unhelpful. But now we have a little bit more clarity from the doctor himself, Dr. Neil Elatrosh, who has certainly
Let's not move Meister to the side too fast.
Dr. James Andrews, of course, the guy we grew used to hearing about doing all the elbow surgeries. Yeah. He's, of course, it's a little bit behind him. Meister and Elatrosh right now are really kind of going head to head.
James Andrews is MJ. Okay. Mm-hmm. Elatrosh is LeBron and Meister is Durant.
Sure. Close enough.
All legends. All legends, all Hall of Famers.
I think,
but Dr. Neil Elatrosh,
Meister doing better than Durant right now. I'm just going to say that.
I think Meister
is still maybe clearly in his prime. I'm not so sure that's the case with KD anymore. But Elatrosh,
Meister's still cooking.
He's making headlines, and he spoke to Cody Stavenhagen of The Athletic for this story updating Tarek Skubal's timeline, and not as much time, but kind of reviewing what happened, what this surgery was. And it's fascinating. I think, honestly, what this reminds me of is something that I did reference when we were starting to project and think about Tarek Skubal's timeline. I did mention the case of Jason Tatum in the NBA coming back from his Achilles injury like faster than almost anybody we'd ever seen. And there have been cases in sports, there's probably other examples, but certainly recently as medical advances have continued, where the best of the best sometimes have access or the opportunity to essentially get revolutionary procedures that can allow them to come back faster. And it sounds like with Cody's reporting and the way Dr. Neil Eletrash is talking, that is basically what has happened
here. Yeah. Another example of this is Winnipeg Jets and Team USA goaltender Connor Hellebuck, who became very famous during the Olympics this year, had a torn meniscus and got the same type of procedure, except on his knee, that Scooble got, and was back in 3 weeks and allowed him to prepare in time for the Olympics, right? So there have been other examples. I don't know what hockey is. I've never heard of it. Based upon what happened to the Sabres last night, I don't even know what it is. But I heard that there was this goaltender named Connor Hellebuck who was good and got healthy. So what are we actually talking about here with Scooble? Okay. And I think what is important to understand is the process that happens between injury and return. Okay. There are really three different phases as I see it. As I, a non-medical professional and former Tommy John recipient, after blowing out in a men's league, this is how I see it. Step one is diagnosis, right? You have a boo-boo, you have pain. The time between that and figuring out what's wrong is step one. It's usually the shortest, okay? Then you get surgery, if you need surgery. And then it is the healing period where you are waiting for the swelling to go down. You are getting range of motion back in whatever joint it is, in this case, your elbow. And then the third stage is building your strength back up, throwing program to get back to where you started. Those are the three blocks. And what has happened here with Scooble is that block two, the healing period, because of the specific procedure he received, and we'll get to that in a second, has been shrunk down where he's going to need significantly less time to recuperate before he restarts his throwing program. And the reason for that is the Nano Needle 2.0, no free ads. But for the Nano Needle, we'll give it to him. This is what Scott Boris, Scooble's agent, called the Scooble Scope, which I think sounds worse than the Nano Needle. I like Nano Needle. Here's the deal. Arthroscopic surgery is basically a needle that goes into someone's body. Doctors listening are probably like, this kid is an idiot. It's a needle that goes into someone's body with a camera on the end that allows the surgeon to kind of see what's going on in there. The Nano Needle is a much smaller device in diameter that enables the surgeon to make a smaller incision and therefore leads to a quicker recovery time. Did I summarize that correctly, Jordan, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I think because
Dr. Jake,
that second part that we're referring to, the swelling, that recovery that your body just needs to do, that involving just like that part of the skin in that area, my understanding, again, the opposite of medical expertise, when you undergo serious surgery, there's just a part of it where your body has to just overcome and recover from that naturally. Sure. And the less invasive that part of it is, seems like now there's less pain, there's less swelling, there's less time that you need to just wait for that part of your body to do it. And because Scooble's specific injury, this is the other thing about it. It's not just the fact that Tarek Scooble is rich and important and that's why he has the access to it. The way that Eletrash describes it in this story is that he was the perfect candidate for this because of what the injury was. The fact that it was this one little area that needed to be addressed that they were able to do using this new procedure, using this new kind of technology and I'm blanking on the exact word. And so that is what has been cut out. Now, does that mean that he's now going to be throwing today? No. But it does seem to shrink the amount of time before doctors are going to clear him to begin that process.
Exactly. Now, I understand, again, I did get Tommy John surgery. It was a very different surgery than what Scooble got. But like my elbow right here, which hopefully you can see, which is, you know, my scar is still there and will be forever. I didn't have full range of motion in my arm for a month, right? And for the first 2 weeks, it's like blue and gross, and like you have to cover it up, and like you have to shower with a bag on. Like there are all these little things that when you get big surgery, for those of you who've gotten any major surgery, like it takes time to get back to being a real person. Scoobal is going to have a much shorter timetable in that regard than he would have. And I appreciate this reporting from Cody Stavenhagen at The Athletic, because this does mirror some of the sentiments that we were getting from John Heyman and getting from Buster Olney via Scott Boras, or Scott Boras via Buster Olney. The difference is that this is like definitive, and this is saying, here's why and how this is different. And I appreciate that, because it allows me to say, oh, this isn't just baseless optimism coming from the player's agent who has a financial stake in them pitching again. This is a medical professional who has some, you know, motivations, surely, but there is a reason why this could be different. So that's the Scoobal situation. Once he gets back throwing, we'll update everybody, but we thought that this was important enough to bring up.
Yeah, because that's the thing. It's not definitive in that now I know he's going to be back sooner, but I at least now understand why he could be. And so yep. I think once he does start throwing and is building up, we will have a better sense as to what that still has not happened yet. He is not out there on the mound. So until that happens, I still think it's impossible to really know what to expect. But now there's reasons to be like, okay, I see why this is different than past examples.
Yeah.
So we will see where we go from here. Okay, a couple other injuries shouts out before we take a break.
Just shouts out to the nano needle and Dr. Riel attach.
No, reattaching is not as, this is more minor. Okay. Let's not be too dramatic. I agree though. Nano needle is a pretty sick term.
Last thing about this, when you read Cody's article, there's like a part in it where he talks about how the loose body, which was cartilage, was like the size of a lima bean, and how they just kind of pluck it out of there. And I just like that, you know, sometimes being a surgeon is like operation, the game. Like you do have to just go in there with some tweezers and like futz around and like pull out a thing, you know, it's great.
Yeah. And I just say one more point about that. That was another thing before the surgery that we was an unknown, which is that sometimes you do go in there and find out that it's actually worse or there's more wrong. And based on this reporting,
there are more loose bodies.
Yeah. Based on this reporting, that doesn't seem to be the case. It does seem like there was this one specific issue that needed to be resolved. That's why he had to go in the IL. That's why he had to get surgery. He wasn't just going to keep pitching through it. But yeah, hopefully Tarik Skubal will be back soon. However, there are a couple other injuries we wanted to mention before we take a break. Max Fried left his start early with what was described as, I believe, elbow posterior soreness. He expressed
posterior elbow soreness. I believe posterior elbows. Posterior, I believe, just means rear in medical terminology.
Oh, okay, like back. Right.
Yeah.
Which seems to be based on his speaking after the game, he didn't seem that worried about it. And this is, it's always weird because sometimes with the, when pitchers leave early, sometimes they pretend like nothing's wrong and something's very wrong. And sometimes they are not hiding at all. And they're like, something is very wrong. And indeed something is very wrong. This seems to be closer to I'm good and it's believable, but where we're at right now, we don't have a clear answer. The fact that he seems to say he was hopeful he would make his next start, but I don't know what to make of this one, but it certainly would be a big deal if he's missing any amount of time.
I think if Max Fried thought something was wrong, we would be able to tell. Now, just because Max Fried, he doesn't seem to think that this is a problem. We'll see what the, you know, Riel attaches of the world say. I do think it's interesting that they said posterior elbow discomfort or soreness or strain or tightness or whatever, because the specificity there you don't always see. And I think that specificity is related to them not wanting to say like internal, which is where usually you get your Tommy John surgery, like the inside of your elbow. And they're saying posterior, which would be the backside of your elbow, which is not always related. Again, this should be the name of the episode. Not a medical professional, but that is my take on the matter. Speaking of other hurt baseball players, Cal Raleigh goes on the IL for the first time in his career with a right oblique strain. We talked about Cal Raleigh's slow start to the season earlier this week, and it does appear that some of that slow start is related to this injury. Jordan, you watch Cal more than I do. You think about Cal more than I do. I would imagine that Cal Raleigh is the type of character that would be hesitant to go on the IL, particularly if Cal Raleigh had never been on the IL in his entire career. And so I could imagine that Cal Raleigh was trying to play through some discomfort that other players in other times and other situations would have ended up on the IL. Instead, Cal played through it. His numbers were not very good. It is good to see that he's going on the injured list at this point.
I agree. I think that that analysis is spot on. And it seemed like he had gotten past it. He had taken a few games off, which was already rare.
Sure.
But because he came back, he got a hit. It was like, okay, now he goes. And then it seems like he tweaked it trying to make a throw.
Yeah.
I think what's most concerning about this just moving forward is, especially with that moment where it seemed like throwing was a challenge, it's a right oblique strain. For a catcher who is a switch hitter, there's a lot going on with Cal Raleigh that is likely going to be impacted by this injury, as evidenced by him playing like garbage
for multiple weeks. See which oblique,
yeah. So
hurts when I do stuff.
How, and that's the thing where it's trying to wonder when he's going to be back. That's a lot of things that have to be feeling good for him to be able to do it. Now, maybe he comes back and he can only swing lefty and he can throw, and maybe he doesn't take as many DH. At-bats right-handed. I don't know. Yeah, DH, like maybe they ease him back in. And they don't wait for all of his, you know, skills to be fully back. That said, that's the part about this that concerns me, but also helps explain why he was not good.
Yes.
So in that sense, you kind
of moral of the story. Hey, guys. It's okay to not be okay. If you're feeling something, whether it's pain in your oblique or emotional discomfort, speak up. Get help. It's okay. And that's Jake's lesson of the day. Francisco Alvarez is getting help too, not on his mental health, but on his torn meniscus. As the Mets lose another key piece, Alvarez headed to the IL. 6 to 8 weeks is the timeline. Got surgery on the knee to repair that torn meniscus. Just another one bites the dust for the Metsies, who will ride with Luis Torrens and Hayden Senger behind the dish. This is a bummer because, I will be the last man out on Francisco Alvarez. I think he is a special player. I think he will be an all-star in the future. He's still only 24, 23. Like, he has a lot 24. Of baseball. 24. He's a lot of baseball still in front of him. He is going to be a really important part of this team once he's back. And hopefully the Mets can weather the storm in his absence. Luis Torrens is a capable guy. Like, as far as backups go, I think he is one of the better ones in the sport. And so the drop off is not enormous. Hayden Senger cannot hit at all, but is totally fine behind the dish defensively. Any other IL thoughts and opinions before we take a break?
No, for Alvarez, it's less about the impact on the Mets, although it does suck because he was playing well. It's just that he's now dealt with what this is like his third injury that's taking him out for multiple weeks or multiple months in his young career. And that is really frustrating because when you're a catcher, you're going to deal with stuff. But as we just talked about, sometimes Cal Raleigh just manages to stay off the IL. Not that it's Francisco Alvarez's fault, but I agree. He's very talented, and that is a bummer. All right, let's take a break. When we return, it's Friday. The Good, the Bad, the Ugly coming right up.
And welcome back to the end of this wonderful episode of Baseball Barbacast. It's Friday, so it is time for the good, the bad, and of course, the ugla. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing wonky, or otherwise reminiscent of the one and only Dan Ugla. My dear friend Jordan Schusterman, I will kick the rock to you.
I am going to talk about a prospect. This week, we got kind of our refreshed top 100 prospect updates from several outlets, whether it's MLB Pipeline or Baseball America. And one that super caught my attention was MLB Pipeline, who has Pirates right-hander Seth Hernandez all the way up to number 3 overall. Now, plenty of top prospects have certainly graduated to make room for that. But I just wanted to shine some light on Seth Hernandez and the incredible start to his career. He was the 6th overall pick in last year's draft. And now, less than a year later, he is the number 3 overall prospect in the minors, or at least, you know, still with rookie eligibility. I'm so impressed with this kid. I talked to him at the combine last year and was like, he gets it. This is not just some guy who has a lot of talent who maybe will figure it out. He is also going to be one heck of a pitcher. And, you know, what's the thing I wanted to mention about him, and he gets off to this incredible start in low A. He got promoted already to high A. He's probably going to make his debut with Greensboro this weekend at some point. But people have pointed out, it's like, oh my God, they got Connor Griffin to fall to them at 9. And now they have Seth Hernandez that they get at 6. Long way to go for Seth Hernandez. He has to prove it. But to me, it's just amazing how similar those arcs are, because Connor Griffin falls to 9 because of his profile, because of the risk associated with a high school player from Mississippi. Seth Hernandez, no one was denying that he was the best position, the best high school pitcher in the draft, and it wasn't even close. Same thing that we were saying about Connor Griffin. But because teams don't want to take that risk early on, he falls to 6, even though I think he was clearly one of the 3 or 4 most talented players in the draft. Pirates pounce again, and it looks like they might have something special. So am I expecting Seth Hernandez to be in the majors this year? No. Although if they want to go super, supersonic and put him in the bullpen in September, I guess that's not impossible. But this is someone to pay attention to. This is a very, very, very special young pitcher.
And I think the Pirates, for all of their kerfuffles, deserve some credit for their last couple of drafts. Skeens, in retrospect, looks like a no-brainer, but he was not. Not at all. And they believed in Skeens being a special enough talent that he was going to figure out his very few inadequacies. The same thing was true with Connor Griffin. This is a unicorn. This is an athletic freak. This kid's gonna figure it out. Let's go for it and kind of, you know, get a different demographic. All three of these guys are slightly risky demographics, right? Where it's like right-handed college guy first overall. You have Griffin, who is a high school kid with hit tool questions, and Seth Hernandez, who is a high school right-hander, right? Those are not safe bets. And I think it's also indicative that a number of the people that were helping to run Pittsburgh's draft have since been plucked by other orgs. And that's a, you know, always a signal that, like, within the industry, they've figured something out and we're doing something correct. We see this all the time. Like, why do you think there are Rays alumni spread out over the league? Because people think they do a good job. So, like, Joe Douglas, who is now with St. Louis, I believe, was with Pittsburgh, was involved with the draft. Justin Horowitz, who is with Pittsburgh, is now with the Nationals. And so it is cool to see the Pirates, you know, get some shine for doing things right. You know, and Seth Hernandez is just the latest example of that.
Indeed. What do you have for good this week?
Mickey frickin' Moniak, dude. Mickey Mo. So Mickey Moniak, a character in our baseballing lives for quite a long time at this point. Mickey, of course, was the number one overall pick in the 2016 MLB draft. And for a long time was looking like a relative bust, one of the worst number one overall picks that we've had in the last 10 years. Didn't work out with him in the Phillies, ends up on the Angels via trade, is competent with the Angels, but not great. Heads over to Colorado. I honestly don't even remember how. He was released. He was straight up released. Not even like waivered, just released by the Angels and ends up on the Rockies and has figured some things out. Mickey Moniak is currently leading baseball in slugging percentage. Now, the park in which he plays certainly helps, as Jordan smiles to himself about that particular fun fact. But an OPS that starts with a 1 is not a fluke this far into the season, even if it is small sample size, even if it is at Coors, that Mickey Moniak has turned into a like an above average major league player is a testament to him sticking with it. Mickey is one of our favorite people in the sport. Even when things were going just poorly, awfully, horribly for him with the Phillies, he had a great positive attitude. People adore this guy. I vividly remember seeing him. Wow. He was still with the Phillies at this point, I think. And he went to the Phillies Padres NLCS game as a fan to support the Phillies. He's from San Diego. And I was walking from the dugout into the tunnel and I just hear, "Yo, Jake." And I look up and it's just Mickey in the stands, like ready to watch the ball game. And like, he's that type of guy that like would show up and go to the game to, even though he's not good enough to be on the roster. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So slight fact check there, because I assume that was 22, which was the year he was traded.
So he had
to the
gotten
Angels.
Traded.
So yeah, but it's Thank still, you. I still think that, the sentiment is still there in a lot of respects, because, you know,
he was supposed to be a part of that thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
like
exactly.
Mickey Moniak was supposed to be an important piece on the 2022 Phillies if you had looked at it from a couple of years before. And
totally.
He was able to kind of crumble up the ego and show up and support the people he cared about. And so I'm just so happy that this guy is going to, like, he's a real big leaguer. Like, he's good. He's a good baseball player. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was showing some of this talent in Anaheim. It was just very kind of volatile. Sure. And in some respects, that's still true. Still striking out a lot. He's not facing lefties. But we said this about a few guys. If you can do this much damage in your specific role, you can be valuable.
Absolutely. Quick tangent here. He had a game on Wednesday where he had a double, a triple, and a home run, but no single. Everything but the cycle, EBTS, which I'm calling an EBITS. EBTS, everything but the cycle. So I looked
everything
up how
but
many...
The single. Everything but the single or everything but the cycle? Everything but the single.
Everything but the single. Everything but the single. Thanks for the edit, Jordan.
Thank you.
Everything but the
Thank
single. You. EBTS. Because cycle starts with a C.
Yes.
Even though it's like a sound, it starts with a C. So everything but the single, how often does this happen? Probably like 5 to 10 times a year. It's not that rare. But I went and looked up how many EBTSs, how many EBITSs there were in EBITS Field. Willie Mays did it. Willie Mays had one of 8 EBITSs in EBITS Field as a visiting player on the Giants. So that's pretty great. So yeah, next time you get a, if you're a broadcaster and you're listening and you get a, you know, single, you get a game where there's a double, triple, homer, no single, throw an EBITS on it. Everything but the single.
Love that. My bad this week is also an UGLA candidate. And that is what happened between the Arizona Complex League Dodgers and the Arizona Complex League Giants. For those who were focused on the Dodgers and Giants playing in the major leagues this week, who cares?
Because not a sicko.
The Giants won a baseball game in front of, do they have attendance on here? Let's see.
No.
They do not list attendance on here. That's disappointing. But it does say that it was 98 degrees at first pitch at 6 p.m. in Arizona. And the reason that this is bad is because the Dodgers lost 29-2 in 7 innings. In fact, all 29 of those runs surrendered were in the first 5 innings. Mm. Just 1 in the first, 4 in the second, 10 in the third, 8 in the fourth, and 6 in the fifth. Talking to some folks around the game, around this game and this situation, this is a much longer, complicated issue, but it is something we want to mention. But
I'm going to write about it next week. And we can talk about it more next week. I mean, so for those of you who've never been to the Complex League, these games are just happening at spring training facilities, right?
Yeah.
And this is developmental. Now, what's happening here is really two things. The Dodgers ran out of pitching and had to use position players as part of it. And the Dodgers signing class stinks because they spent all that money on Roki Sasaki.
So that has combined to create a pitching staff right now. Now, granted, the league ERA in the Complex League through about 10 games is 5.91. Their team ERA, and yes, this game certainly put a dent in it, is now up to 1176. This team has walked 87 guys in 69 innings, and it's just, this is a mess. It's 24 yep. wild pitches, 14 hit by pitches. A lot of these kids are not ready to be pitching at this level, and that is what is creating a messy product, which I know is not really a product that is being sold to an audience. So it's, in that sense, it feels lower stakes. But there are developmental problems with this current situation, and that is, I think, what I know you want to write about.
Yeah, it's also a waste of a lot of people's time and is actively detrimental to certain players. Now, the Dodgers are a particular example. They're a little different here for two reasons that are related. One is that they have more injured pitchers in the minor leagues than pretty much anybody. The Orioles are right up there. But the reason for that, so when they have all these injured pitchers, what happens is they have to rush guys up to fill these spots who aren't ready from the Dominican complex. As one person put it to me, we have to microwave these guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And what happens then is that because all these guys are getting injured, the reason they're getting injured is because the Dodgers are going out and looking for dudes that throw really freaking hard, and they're emphasizing stuff over command. And guess what? That's worked really well for them. Like, the Dodgers know how to develop arms. Now, a lot of them get hurt. Yeah. And so when you look at this lower level, the Dodgers complex league team is going to be dudes that have big stuff over guys that are touch and feel. And that's how you end up with all these walks instead of guys that know how to throw strikes. So it's all these things kind of coming together to create a 29-2 score.
Yeah, I will say, and then I'll throw it to you for your bad. There are Giants fans listening to this saying, well, hey, what about those two amazing prospects at the top that had 8 hits and combined for 13 RBIs? That they are good. Josuar Gonzalez and Luis Hernandez, they are good. And we will talk about them more, I'm sure, in the future. But the takeaway from this game was not their performance. It was what the hell is going on over on the other side. So that is why we wanted to mention it here in the bad. But go ahead.
My bad this week is very different. Very different. My bad is an in-game snack. The sideline reporter for the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet, one of their sideline reporters is named Anna Dua. Anna Dua, I believe, also does hockey. I've never heard of hockey before. Anna Dua's in-game snack was the following. It was mustard on ice.
I mean, I think the degree to which this went viral speaks to just what more do you need me to add to this? I mean, mustard, I'll say this. Mustard is a condiment that I pretty much didn't like at all until now. I'll do it in the right circumstance. Not the right circumstance. So, bad. Agreed. Bad. Yes. I have no further notes.
So, Anna Dua went on Sabres Live to tell the story of this for some reason, which is hilarious. She explains that she doesn't have a sweet tooth, not a sweet person. So there was a shaved ice dispenser near where she was doing her hit for like in game for the Blue Jays. She wanted shaved ice. She was hot. And so she didn't want to just eat the ice. She didn't like the flavors they had. And she likes mustard. And so she just put the mustard over the ice to see how it tasted, tweeted it, didn't think it was going to be a big thing.
So in some ways, this is good because,
I agree. I agree. And here's why this is good. Here's why this is good. Stand on business.
For sure. Like, she ain't ducking at all.
She's like, yeah, I like mustard. I'm putting it on ice and I'm eating it on the broadcast and I'm telling everyone about it. Now, is this kind of disgusting? Yes, but she believes in it. What's the quote from Zoolander? I don't listen to Sting's music, but the fact that he's making it, I respect that. And that's how I feel about Anna Dua.
But I also, now she just has to know that this is just going to follow her. Now she's just a mustard. People are just going to be giving her mustard all
mustard
the time.
Mustard queen.
And I don't know if that was what she necessarily signed up for, but maybe that is the case. So
mustard! Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. There's the collab that will probably happen at some point. All right, let's go to Ugla. My Ugla this week is that Josh Bell stole a base. Oh my goodness, folks.
Is he going to give it back?
His first steal since September 27th, 2018, which the great Sarah Langs tells us, 978 games between stolen bases, the longest streak ever. I love this so much. What is Ugla about it is how he got it, which was first and third situation. He's on first. He takes off. Marlins catcher Joe Mack is like, ooh, should I throw to third? Should I throw down? Or is the guy from third going to come home? He kind of hesitates, and Josh Bell kind of scampers over and steals second base, which is amazing.
Is that a steal? Is that defensive indifference?
Well, it can't be neither, defensive indifference, really. Because I think the game was, it's neither. There needs to be a term for this, though. I do agree with you.
It's uncontested is what it is.
Yes. Not indifferent, but he did end up throwing down. It was just a little bit late. But I did just want to take this as an opportunity to mention. Now, Josh Bell did have a steal in his career before this. It was just a gap between. But I did just want to use this as an opportunity to mention the guys right now who have not stolen yet, who we can now watch.
The bagless. The swipers.
There are two, names to know. The swiper,
the swiper, no swipers.
The people who watch Dora and
they're like, okay.
Their takeaway was like, I promise, sure. I would never.
Okay, no swiping.
Two guys, two active players, over 900 career plate appearances, no steals. They are Spencer Horwitz of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Okay.
Who's at 978. Jonathan Aranda of the Tampa Bay Rays at 936. Next, you have to go all the way down to Dylan Dingler at 704. That's disappointing to me because Dylan Dingler is one of the fastest catchers in the league. But he has not stolen a base yet.
He ain't got time for that.
Those are the guys to
Dylan
watch.
Dingler knows how embarrassing it can be as a catcher to have someone steal on you, and he doesn't want to create that shame for somebody else.
Oh, interesting. That's good spin zone. For those wondering, the record is 2,700 plate appearances by Russ Nixon, who played in the 50s and 60s. So long way to go for Aranda and Horwitz to catch those guys, but that is the gold standard of not swiping. So there you go. There's my Ugla.
Don't swipe, kids. My Ugla this week is Will Smith being a goofball. Will Smith of the Los Angeles Dodgers is famously one of the more stoic and publicly humorless individuals we have in our sport. Is that fair, Jordan?
Certainly front-facing, yes.
Yeah, publicly. Will Smith has been in our baseball lives now for almost a decade, and for much of that time has been a major character on the most important team as the catcher of the Los Angeles Dodgers. I have never seen him act this goofy before. During the Dodgers-Giants game last night on Thursday night, Will Smith, who was DHing, was just putting little pieces of gum, wrapped gum, inside the hood of Yoshinobu Yamamoto while they were on the bench, and got like 8 of them in there, which to the point that it started weighing down Yoshinobu Yamamoto's hoodie. Now, this type of thing happens all the time in the dugout, I understand. But Will Smith being the culprit, being the prankster, being the fun-loving, whimsical goofball is not something that I saw coming. And Will Smith, let me say, I apologize. I was not familiar with your game, I guess.
Yeah, I guess like DH Will Smith is just a totally different personality. You didn't have to worry about catching.
That's it.
And which, by the way, the other funny thing about that sequence was they showed Ohtani sitting on the bench. Ohtani getting the whole day off. After he pitched, you know, the night before, they decided for him to not hit 2 days in a row. And Ohtani was just sitting there in his jacket. That alone was just weird to look at him and just like not be ready to play baseball. Like, that was so strange. But I think Will Smith clearly embracing his limited role. He had a leadoff home run and Giants won and ended up splitting that series. So I agree. A lot of Ugla going on there.
Jordan Schusterman, that is our show. Yeah, thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. Thank you to you, Jordan, for doing the show with me. Thank you to all the rivals out there. Hate. And then before we get out of here, a little shout out. The Division III baseball regionals are this weekend, and my beloved Washington University St. Louis Bears are taking on Aurora University in Danville, Kentucky. I will not be there. But there is a Division III baseball regional happening probably within driving distance of you. And if you are a sicko and would like to take in some free baseball, or maybe free, but definitely cheap.
Not free. Sorry, not free, definitely sorry. Cheap. This is the only definitely time they will baseball. Ever charge for a D3 game.
You can sit real close and watch some baseball that people really care about. Really care about. So... yep. If you're a weirdo like us and you want to go do that, I highly recommend. Go Bears. Go Bears. Go Bears. The one storyline to watch in that is that the Denison Big Red, they have lost one game the entire season, which is basically unprecedented.
It was their second game of the year, so they're on like a W40. They are the top overall seed in the tournament. But I'm sure we'll have some special moments from that tournament. The softball tournament starts this weekend. This is a very, very, very fun time of year. So enjoy the sports, folks. Enjoy the bat and ball sports, I should say. Thank you all for listening. Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com, and we will recap the rivalries on Monday. See ya.